News color coverage of the epic journey of Apollo 11 will continue in a moment.
Watch this CBS station for continuing CBS News color coverage of Man on the Moon, the epic journey of Apollo 11. This is CBS. CBS News color coverage of Man on the Moon. The epic journey of Apollo 11. CBS News Space Center in New York with the latest developments from the Apollo 11 moon mission, correspondent Walter Cronkite.
I know that anything can match the excitement of that landing on the moon, successful landing on the moon of a few hours ago, unless it's man stepping out on the moon, and that's due to come 45 minutes from now. The hatch is due to be opened. The men are getting on their spacesuits, their helmet, their gloves, their boots, even at this moment, and donning their portable life support system that would give them 4 hours of oxygen and of cooling water supply and provides their communications. They're getting that on now, and they're due to open the hatch just about 45 minutes from now. One who must have been one of the most excited with this landing today is Dr. William Pickering, the director of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and one of the dreamers and workers toward this day. He's with Bill Stout at North American Rockwell in Downey, California.
Walter, I'm sure you remember, and I know that Dr. Pickering certainly hasn't forgotten those long, long nights of waiting to find out about the first probe sent to the moon. How does it feel, Dr. Pickering, seeing what's happening up there today and thinking back to the early days of Ranger?
Well, of course, we lived through some of these landings on the moon with the Rangers and the Surveyors, and all the tension and all the excitement of the unmanned mission, of course, was accentuated manyfold when we knew that a man was bringing the spacecraft down as he did today. And so this was a most exciting day in the whole history of the program, there's no question about it.
You know, there's been an argument for years about manned versus unmanned, which is more efficient, more economical, and really it's an argument that's almost revived today with the mystery of Luna 15 circling the moon at the same time Apollo is there. Does it seem to you, sir, that that whole dispute has become completely irrelevant with the landing?
I think it's irrelevant because there are always things for man to do and there are things for instruments to do. The instruments of the early unmanned probes have paved the way for the Apollo. They've shown us shown us how to navigate to the moon. We've shown what the surface of the moon actually looks like. We've got a good idea of what it's going to be like when Armstrong steps out on the moon in a few minutes. And this has all been an essential part of the total development. And if we look ahead, we can see that the exploration of the moon will require both manned and unmanned devices. There are going to be parts of the moon which are going to be very difficult to get to with a manned vehicle. And these we expect will be explored with unmanned devices. Man, however, will certainly be a key part of the exploration. And as a matter of fact, of course, when we talk about unmanned spacecraft, we have to remember that really there's a man involved. The man may be sitting down here on the Earth instead of in the spacecraft, but the sorts of devices which are being flown nowadays are complex devices with command capabilities, with control capabilities, and a man must somewhere be making those decisions. And so we have manned and unmanned devices working together to explore space.
You have some unmanned devices, to use your word, coming up very shortly, Mariners to Mars.
We do indeed.
What do you expect from them?
We expect to get some very good photographs, or at least, shall we say, much better photographs of Mars than anything we have seen so far. We expect to photograph the entire disk of the planet in much better detail than we can see it from Earth. And we also expect to get some close-up pictures of the planet, which will be very much better than anything we've seen before.
Could we come close, do you think, in these two Mariner missions to answering the two old nagging questions about the canals and whether there's life on Mars?
I think we ought to answer the question about the canals, because if the canals can be seen from Earth, they will certainly be seen in our photographs. On the question of life on Mars, that's another question. I think to really answer that, we'll have to get down to the surface. This, of course, we hope to do in a few years.
You think that's the next step in unmanned exploration?
The unmanned exploration of Mars is going to go through a mission in about two years. In 1971, we were going to orbit around the planet and make some really detailed examination of the planet. And then in 1973, we'll come down to the surface and begin the real surface exploration of the planet, which will be necessary before we can answer that question about life. And I personally happen to think that question about life on Mars is indeed one of the most fascinating questions which we can ask in the whole era of space exploration.
You think we can answer it that soon? Hmm?
We're not going to necessarily get an answer in 73, but that is the first step.
It may seem crass, Dr. Pickering, to put a question in competitive terms on this day, when, as Walter has said repeatedly, the feeling is one of overwhelming emotion. But do you think, considering again Luna 15, that the Russians are ahead of us in the unmanned area? They've done so much of it, so far out in space.
The Russians have, of course, had a very active unmanned program, both to the moon and to the planets. The Russians have not landed anything on the moon yet. And, of course, Surveyor has landed successfully. There are five Surveyors sitting on the moon, one of them not so very far away from Tranquility Base. And on the other hand, in the planets, the exploration of the planets, the Russians have sent probes into the atmosphere of Venus. So I would say that both of us have had an active program. In some areas, they're ahead of us. In other areas, we're ahead of them.
Do we share a great deal of this information?
The scientific information does get shared in international discussions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you mentioned Surveyor. It's one estimate I read from Mission Control in Houston was that it's perhaps 20 miles from where Armstrong and Aldrin put down.
Mm-hmm. It's not very many miles away. We'll wait until we get a final landing point for Armstrong's mission, and then we'll see just how far away it is to Surveyor. I think it'd be fascinating for them to be able to go over and have a look at Surveyor, but I'm afraid it's too far away for that.
Perhaps on another mission. What would it be like scientifically if an astronaut could go over and bring back a piece of this artifact that had been sitting up there for a few years? Would you learn anything from it?
Yes, you would. And as a matter of fact, you would like to find out, for example, how much damage has been done by meteorites. And here's something sitting on the moon. If we could examine it closely, we could find if it had been hit by any meteorites, if anything had damaged it during it. And we'd know exactly how long it had been there. And so this would be very useful information. But I think also, though, just the human information to actually just see the Surveyor would be the most fascinating thing.
And that, Walter, maybe one of the things that we can look forward to next as the space program continues.
CBS News color coverage of the epic journey of Apollo 11 will continue in a moment. Carried to the surface of the moon today in the lunar module, as has been reported earlier, as revealed by the White House, as a matter of fact, on last Thursday, as these men were on the way to the moon, are medals commemorating the flights of the five astronauts, three astronauts and two cosmonauts who have died in their training program or in space flight. The three Americans, Gus Grissom and Ed White and Chaffee on the American Apollo 204, which had a fire, as you know, on the launching pad in Florida as they were rehearsing and practicing for their flight. That was in January 1967, and the two Russians who have died. Komarov, whose parachute fouled as he returned from a space flight, and Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, who died in a training airplane accident. Medals have gone to the moon. Some of the actual Gagarin and Komarov medals given to Frank Borman when he was over in Russia not very long ago, and three mementos for Grissom, White, and Chaffee. And the courage of the families of the three American astronauts who died in preparing for this success of this mission today and contributed to it with their previous space flights and with the preparations they had made up to the time of the fatal fire is remarkable. Particularly, I think, if any could be singled out in the White family. Ed White, who was our first space walker. His father is a general in the Air Force, and he went right out and spoke for the space program around the United States, as he's continued to do, to impress people with the necessity for the program to go on and how his son would have wished for it to go on. And today, Pat White, widow of Ed White, was one of the first neighbors to rush into Neil Armstrong's home there in, outside of Houston at the Space Center. She still lives there with the White children. She was there to offer her congratulations, smiling, happy congratulations. She said, "I couldn't be happier. It's the culmination of a dream, a culmination for a lot of people. Ed would have been thrilled to see this day come." The lunar module, we have been told now by Houston, is so positioned on the moon that the leg, one of the four legs of the lunar module with the ladder on it, the nine-step ladder that will take man down to the surface of the moon, is turned about 13 degrees south of the ground track. That is, it's facing a little bit west of, or south of west, as the lunar module sits on the moon. It therefore will be in the shadow of the sun, which is behind the lunar module. As the men get out about 40 minutes from now and begin to climb down that ladder for the walk on the moon. One of the problems that Armstrong and Aldrin are going to have during their walk is moving about gracefully, if that's a concern to them, on the lunar surface. The spacesuit they must wear has been described as a spacecraft in its own right, Jared Wally said a moment ago, since it has to protect the men against radiation, meteorites, great heat and cold, and of course the lack of oxygen. And as a result, it's quite bulky and awkward. It restricts movement considerably. It's kind of like a rigid balloon. We have an intriguing and colorful report on the suit now from James Burke, a correspondent for the British Broadcasting Corporation.
Good evening. When the first American astronaut steps out onto the surface of the moon, this is what he'll be wearing. It's called an extravehicular mobility unit, better known as a space suit. And the people who built it call it the astronaut's own personal spacecraft, since it has incorporated in it all the systems the spacecraft does to keep the astronaut alive and, above all, protected from the totally alien environment all around him. Now, probably the first thing you notice about this suit as I talk is a constant hiss in the background behind my voice. Well, the astronaut learns to live with that. That's why he's alive. It's a noise made by the inflow of the air into his suit, which either comes, if he's in the spacecraft, through a tube like that, or if he's outside, coming in through from his backpack strapped on the back there. The whole suit weighs more than I do, and it's tremendously complicated and cumbersome, obviously because it's not meant to be worn walking around in the full gravity of Earth. It takes the astronauts, after some years of practice, only 5 minutes to put it on and take it off. It takes me a lot longer than that without help. So to show you how it's made up, I'm going to get some help to, as it were, do a space undress. First off are the extravehicular gloves, the gloves that are worn when the astronaut's outside the spacecraft. They unlock from a metallic ring on the sleeve and are covered with layers of insulating material. Each glove is tailored to fit each astronaut's individual hand. On his back, the emergency oxygen supply and backpack. Now, that's what keeps him alive when he's out on the lunar surface or doing some extravehicular activity in space, walking between the two spacecraft. That, for example, is necessary possibly during an emergency. That has enough systems on board to keep him alive, warm, and relatively happy for 4 hours. On his head, there are three basic sets of visors. The first one, going down now, is the visor that protects against meteorite impacts. And the second one, going down now, gold-covered, protects against glare. And they are fitted on to a kind of over-helmet, which comes straight off, revealing underneath the basic plastic pressure helmet. This is the seal that keeps the astronaut alive when he's inside the suit, and the seal is undone simply by unscrewing the pressure helmet from, and with a little difficulty in my case, from the top of the neck of the suit. Underneath the basic pressure helmet, the communications helmet with small microphones and earpieces in order to communicate with either the spacecraft or via the spacecraft mission control at Houston back on Earth. You notice there the change in noise as the pressure helmet came off. Now this air that's entering through the tube is venting itself up behind my head. On his feet, the astronaut has, as he's out on the lunar surface, lunar overboots. And these are popped on and strapped. And they go on over the top of the basic integral suit boot. And as this one comes off, you'll see that the boot itself, the basic boot, is part of the leg of the spacesuit itself. And what's left is this, the integrated thermal meteoroid garment, which does exactly what it says. It keeps the astronaut warm, and it protects him from meteoric impact. It's covered all over with flaps and pockets and controls and containers. And before we show you what's underneath, let's get some more help and get this nozzle, air nozzle, undone. And take out the communications links. And now you'll see just how difficult it is for those astronauts to get the garment off in space. And if you can do that in a spacecraft, then you've got good reason to go to the moon. Here then, the entire outer part of the spacesuit. And so the astronaut outside his spacecraft has now only one more garment underneath. This one, the liquid cooling garment, as it's called. And it answers the problem that they discovered on the Gemini flights, related to the fact that once in an extravehicular spacesuit, an astronaut can get extremely hot doing very simple tasks. This garment answers that problem. Cooling liquid is pumped in through these large tubes and then routed away through lots of very small tubes that run along next to the astronaut's skin and tacked on behind the net-like substance of this garment. And Rusty Schweikart describes the effect of this garment as being very pleasant, like stepping into a cold shower. And from there, we're left with two understandably very basic problems. How do they deal with their waste products? Well, liquid waste is piped away along a permanently attached tube to a metallic reservoir that's set here on the stomach. And solid waste is dealt with by these underpants filled with a highly absorbing material and acting rather like baby's nappies. So that's it, down to the skin. And after all that performance, it doesn't surprise me that all the astronauts want to do when they get back to Earth is head straight for the bath. Fly me to the moon and let me sing the romance song. Let me one night find the heart of Jupiter and Mars.
James Burke of BBC in a comic conclusion to what was a very informative little demonstration of the extravehicular suit, the space suit, that men will wear in their first excursion to the moon. And that's due about 25 minutes from now. About 9:30 to 9:35, somewhere in there, the hatch should open, and 10 minutes later, Neil Armstrong will step out to begin the descent from the lunar module to the moon's surface. CBS News color coverage of the epic journey of Apollo 11 will continue in a moment.
Watch this CBS station for continuing CBS News color coverage of Man on the Moon, the epic journey of Apollo 11. This is CBS. CBS News color coverage of Man on the Moon. The epic journey of Apollo 11. This evening, a walk on the moon.
But never too far, because there seems nothing so majestic as the sea enraged, driven by the wind, pulled by the moon. So inexorable is the tide, so relentless, that across a span of several centuries, a drop in the bucket of time, the tide turned the French Abbey Mont-Saint-Michel from a tree-surrounded refuge near the coast to an island outpost, a fortress protected by high walls, and once a day by high tide, tide that is tugged by the moon until it surrounds the old fort, with waters more than 60 feet deep, covering the road that leads out to it, protecting it completely in a way no knight of old could have hoped or planned his castle would be made safe. Man couldn't protect this fortress as well as the moon. While man in the past could not harness the tide to do his bidding, sailors early knew they must sail by the tide and return by it, men learned to live with it, and finally to take advantage of it. The Nance River hydroelectric plant in France, where engineers harnessed the tidal flow in and out of the English Channel, forcing the water through reversible turbines, so that as the moon caused the tides to come and go, a constant supply of electricity was produced to power much of France. Before man fully understood his universe, not to say he really does now, the unexplained had to be explained nonetheless, and so it was with moon and tide. One mythmaker once likened the moon to a great silver bird circling above the earth, lighting the earth, he decided, and brushing the sea with its wingtips, piling up the ocean's waters as it flew overhead. Now, two men sit on the moon, looking down at the blue earth, at the waters of earth controlled so long by the moon, and still answering only to it.
It would be nice to think that we in the United States can look up at the moon tonight and as we gaze upon it, think of two fellow Americans sitting there on the surface and shortly walking around on that surface. But David Shoemaker a little while ago asked Gordon Barnes, our consulting meteorologist here at CBS, about the weather across the United States, and it turns out it's cloudy or partly cloudy over most of the United States tonight, interfering considerably with a look at the moon. Over most of the eastern part of the United States, the cloud cover is complete, and there'll be no glimpse of the moon at all. That's true over the a lot of the Great Plains State area as well. The rest of the country is partly cloudy, except for a portion of the western states beyond the Rocky Mountains, most of California, and up into Nevada, and over into western Washington and Oregon, it's fairly clear. The rest of the nation, cloudy. So we might not be able to look up and gaze on that old orb and think tonight not of lovers and of moon and croon and spoon, but of Armstrong and Aldrin as they sit there on the moon's surface. We've just been advised by my mission control in Houston, who were in contact with the men in the lunar module, of course, that they're having a little more difficulty getting into their suits and preparing to walk on the moon than they had anticipated, and that they're running about 30 minutes late in that preparation, so that would mean the hatch were not open now till around 10 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, or 45 minutes from now. They may pick up some of that time, and we shouldn't be surprised to learn that they are ready before then, but the last word is that they are running about 30 minutes behind schedule. This is still far better than we had all thought. According to the flight plan, they weren't going to open that hatch until after 2 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time tomorrow morning and make the space walk. Now, as if you've been tuned in with us, you know they have decided, as indeed had been anticipated for several days, that with the excitement of being on the moon's surface, they can't wait to get out, and they don't want to spend 4 hours of rest period, which was dictated by the flight plan. They asked permission a little while ago of Mission Control. Mission Control readily gave it, with the concurrence of Dr. Charles Berry, the astronaut's physician, that they indeed should go ahead and make the spacewalk as early as they can get ready for it, that Dr. Berry and nobody else would expect them to sleep at a moment like this, let alone just get some rest. This despite the fact that their sleeping hours last night were considerably restricted. They had a little communications problem just before they go to bed, and it took them about an hour to get it straightened out with the ground. It turned out the problem was on the ground in the first place, but it restricted their sleep to five and a half and 6 hours for the three astronauts, considerably less than the 8 hours they'd planned. But they all seem to be in good shape tonight. Michael Collins circling around overhead, the good watchdog that he is, important member of this team, who is in the command module, 69 miles overhead in orbit, and Armstrong and Aldrin there on the moon's surface. George Herman is at Cinder Lake in Flagstaff, Arizona, for a report on the importance of lighting conditions for the walk on the moon. George?
Here at Cinder Lake, the United States Geological Survey has built an exact replica of part of the lunar landing site. And at the moment, the sun is almost exactly at the prescribed angle of 10 degrees. Visibility is good in almost every direction except directly into the sun. But it would be best for the astronauts if they were to look and to walk at about 90 degrees, crosswise to the path of the sun. Then everything will stand out sharply. Their only real problems may come if they try to walk into their own shadows, 28 feet long and blacker than any shadows here on Earth. Additionally, around the head in their shadow will be a bright halo of light, a reflected glare whiting out all the detail on the surface of the moon at that point. It's impossible to duplicate that kind of backscatter reflection here on the Cinder Lake, so the scientists have built a replica of one of the surveyor landing sites, and it shows the effect dramatically. This is a 1/5 scale model of Surveyor 5 and the lunar surface on which it rests, reproduced in meticulous detail. Our sun is at the proper elevation of about 10 degrees, but is shooting crosswise to the camera, and that brings out every crater in vivid detail. Notice particularly the small cluster of craters behind the omnidirectional antenna, that boom which sticks out to the right of Surveyor 5 like an arrow. Now, as our sun begins to move around until eventually we'll find it shining directly over the camera's shoulder, the surface grows brighter and brighter, the detail grows less and less, and finally that group of craters has disappeared altogether. This phenomenon was clearly shown by surveyors' photographs. And Dr. Elliot Morris, co-investigator of the Surveyor television program, demonstrates it.
This is a mosaic of Surveyor 5 pictures taken on the lunar surface. The sun is at a low angle above the horizon in this direction. This is the omni antenna of the spacecraft. Here's the shadow of the antenna. There is considerable detail in this area. Here is the small cluster of craters that Mr. Herman pointed out on the Surveyor 5 model. In our next mosaic, which was taken at a different sun angle, here again is the omni antenna, the shadow of the antenna. There's little detail in this area here. Here is where the small cluster of craters were that Mr. Herman pointed out. They are now invisible at this sun angle. In the next mosaic, as we view the pictures, the sun is coming from behind. And as you can see, there's no detail at all in this area around the shadow of the solar panels on the Surveyor 5 spacecraft.
This is a sample of the fine powder used to simulate the lunar surface on the model. On the model, it looked bright enough, almost white, but here you can see it's dark gray, almost black. Its unique property is that it reflects light back towards the source. Backscatter, it's called. Dr. Morris, will this backscatter effect pose any dangers to the astronauts?
We don't anticipate any danger. However, there will be an inconvenience in making observations on the moon's surface. If they observe in the direction of the sun, of course, this will be very difficult. In looking in the direction towards their shadow, they will not see detail in the shadow. However, at that point around the shadow, around their head, of course, it will be whited out and no detail. This will be an area about 15 or 20 feet across.
And about 28 feet away from them.
That is correct.
But there's no difficulty or danger in that?
We don't anticipate any danger. If they want to make observations in that direction, they will only have to step aside to see that area that was whited out.
So inconvenience, but no danger.
That is correct.
Thank you very much, Dr. Morris.
And now a late word from Houston, the manned space center, that the extravehicular activity, man's walk on the moon, should begin about 9:50 p.m. or a half hour from now. CBS News color coverage of the epic journey of Apollo 11 will continue in a moment. Man on the moon. He's been there now for 5 hours in this new era. We've come past the era when man was trapped on this planet of his, the era that lasted from the time he emerged from the primeval ooze a billion or so years ago. Now we are truly men of the universe. The way paved for us by this 38-year-old graduate from Purdue, a veteran of combat in the Navy and in the Air Force, that is, in Korea, Neil Armstrong from Wapakoneta, Ohio, and Buzz Aldrin, a graduate of West Point, fifth in his class, considered the best scientific brain in the space program among the astronauts. They're on the moon, and they're due to step foot on it in another half hour or so from now. They're preparing for that walk on the moon, even as we report this. Where they are on the moon, however, is still something of a question. Houston has pinpointed them as only 4 miles beyond the planned landing spot, but it seems that they may be some distance from that particular point. But they don't know apparently yet themselves up there, and Houston doesn't know precisely. Bruce Morton at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston has a report on why there's this difficulty in pinpointing Eagle's position on the moon. Bruce?
Well, Walter, it seems that there are a number of problems, really. First of all, as you know, it's not the easiest thing in the world to keep a completely accurate track of the lunar module, even when it's in orbit. There are always slight inaccuracies one way or the other. Second, the burn that took them down, the powered descent, didn't go exactly the way the computer said it was supposed to. One of the crew, I remember, said fairly early that they thought they were going to come out downrange of where they should have been, and then there was the maneuvering at the end when Armstrong spoke later of this field of boulders, field of rocks that he wanted to avoid. So that took them some distance off the prescribed path. And then there's the fact that they didn't recognize anything. It would have helped, of course, if they could have said, oh, yes, that's such and such a rill or such and such a crater. But that didn't happen. On Earth, you could solve all this in a fairly straightforward fashion with radio. The Eagle is emitting radio signals, and you could take two other stations and triangulate and know exactly where it is. But apparently with an object that's a quarter of a million miles away, that's a lot harder to do. People here say they will get a precise fix eventually, but not now. Walter?
Meanwhile, they would like to get that fix before these fellows step out onto the moon's surface, and out at the astrogeological laboratories in Flagstaff, Arizona, they're working pretty hard, racing time, really. They'd like to know before they step out so they can tell them something about the area they're in, perhaps even to warn them of hidden pitfalls in the area, although more precisely, they'd like to be able to tell them what kind of rocks they think are in the area and perhaps direct them where to go in that 100-foot circle that they will traverse away from their spacecraft to pick up the given rocks. The astrogeologists here on Earth are terribly excited about the fact that Armstrong and Aldrin reported that there are a lot of rocks of various kinds around them. So it looks like they're in an area where the rock samples they'll bring back will give a good cross-section of that particular portion of the moon and give the scientists here on Earth a lot to work with. Bringing those moon rocks back, of course, is the top priority item, other than the men themselves coming back safely. And the first thing that Neil Armstrong will do when he steps onto the surface of the moon is to use a little scoop on a long handle, because he can't bend over in that inflated spacesuit that makes him really a kind of a man in a balloon. He's going to scoop up a sample of the Earth's surface and put it in the little sack that he scoops up with into his pocket of his spacesuit, so that no matter what happens from there on, if they have to leave the moon suddenly or something of the kind, at least there will be that sample of the Earth's surface brought back to Earth. The most exciting part for us on Earth of the walk on the moon is that as soon as Armstrong gets out of that spacecraft, he will deploy that little 7.5-pound Westinghouse camera that will give us black and white pictures of the entire 2 hours and 40 minutes of activities on the moon, of course, if it works all right. It should. The landing was soft enough. It's mounted on in a equipment tray down at the bottom of the lunar module of the descent stage. And if it survived the landing all right and deploys all right, certainly the signal strength from the landing craft seems to be good back to Houston. And we should be able by one of the, or several of the dishes around the Earth that are in Madrid and in Australia and in Goldstone, California, get a picture of these men on the moon. Incidentally, Mike Collins up there in the command module where he orbits around, keeping an eye on these fellows by radio at any rate, and waiting for them to come and rendezvous again with him sometime tomorrow evening. He pointed out to David Shoemaker in their interview down in Houston a couple of weeks ago that he's going to be the few people on Earth. He's going to be the only man around the moon and one of the few human beings who is not going to have access to a television camera to see this walk on the moon. He doesn't have a receiver up there, a television receiver, I should say, not camera. He has a camera there. He doesn't have a receiver, though. He's not going to be able to see the pictures being transmitted from the moon. He's going to be one of the few. And he asked David Shoemaker to be sure that CBS holds a tape of this transmission for him, because he wants to see it as soon as he gets back to Earth. Terry Drinkwater and Leo Krupp out at North American Rockwell, where they build the command module, Downey, California, can tell us what Michael Collins is up to in that command module right now without television to watch. Gentlemen?
Right now, Walter, he's attempting to sight the lunar spacecraft on the surface of the moon, and it hasn't been successful so far, has it, Leo? What devices is he using to try to find it down there?
Well, Terry, Mike has been busy during this period since he's been solo in the spacecraft doing some housekeeping chores in the spacecraft. He's removed the center couch and has it stowed so he has the center aisle open. He can move around quite freely. And this is also in the event that a contingency EVA is necessary when we do affect the rendezvous later on tomorrow. But as you say, his primary concern right now is to track the lunar module setting on the lunar surface. And to this point in time, he has been unsuccessful. He has not been able to really spot it and track it. Now, what he's using is the sextant, which is a part of the GNN system. It's a 28-power telescope, and he's using that to try to pick up the lunar module setting on the surface as the orbit of the command module comes over the top of the landing site. He's receiving information from the ground, which is giving him an attitude to fly the spacecraft to and also automatically pointing his optics. But so far, he has been unsuccessful to really spot him.
Is that a difficult device to use, or is it simply because the LEM is so small and he is in an orbit of 60 miles?
Well, the pointing information that the ground's passing up would have to be extremely accurate, because the field of view of the sextant is only 1.8 degrees. So you're really looking at a very small segment of the lunar surface, so the information that's passed up would have to be extremely accurate to allow Mike to pick it up with the sextant. But if he gets good pointing information, which I'm sure he will here, maybe on the next orbit, he will be able to pick it up and track it. And one reason we're interested in tracking the LEM, at least on one pass, is to be sure that the command module orbit is directly over the landing site, because if it's not, we may have to make a plane change correction to get it over the landing site, because when the LEM makes its ascent tomorrow, we would like to be in a plane directly with it. This will facilitate the rendezvous and subsequent docking tomorrow.
So, Walter, this particular space vehicle, the Columbia, may not be the most important right now, but tomorrow it will be very important indeed. Back to you.
Leo, are you suggesting that if they don't pinpoint the location of this before the liftoff tomorrow, that we've got a serious problem in affecting rendezvous?
No, Walter, I don't think so, because we're pretty sure the LEM is down pretty close to right in the center of the landing site, so we're probably orbiting right over it. But as of right now, we have not been able to track it from the command module, which we would like to do on one pass to ascertain that we really are in orbit directly over the landing site.
Of course, Mike Collins is going to have quite a few more chances to pinpoint it if the liftoff is not until 1:55 tomorrow afternoon Eastern Daylight Time, as it is in the flight plan, and that may be a good reason for keeping the men on the surface of the moon for that long period after they complete their extravehicular activity this evening to let him spot it. He's coming around over their site every 2 hours in his orbit 69 miles high, and that means in the next 14 hours, he gets 7 chances to pick up the spacecraft, and he certainly ought to be able to do it by then, wouldn't you think, Leo?
Well, I certainly hope so, Walter, and I'm sure that the experts at At the Spacecraft Center, the flight directors are working up a new batch of data for Mike on this next pass, so he'll get some refined pointing information. And if he can get a good spacecraft attitude and good optics pointing, he should be able to pick it up through that section. It's 28 par, but the narrow field of view, 1.8 degrees, makes it necessary that we really have good information to point it.
All right. CBS News coverage of man's first landing on the moon will continue in a moment.
Now here again is Walter Cronkite.
How easy these words are rolling off our lips now. Man on the moon, a walk on the moon. And yet, to say the words and to stop just a moment to think about them still sends a shiver up and down the old spine. It's 9:35 Eastern Daylight Time, and that means that very probably, unless we hear otherwise, we will get word from the spacecraft that they intend to depressurize the cabin and open the hatch in about 15 minutes from now. Around 9:50 was the last estimate we had from the Manned Space Center in Houston as to the opening time for the that hatch. World reaction, of course, has been great in all of the Western world. Congratulatory messages flowing in from kings and prime ministers and presidents from around the world. In Russia, there has been no congratulatory message sent yet from Moscow, which was soundly beaten, clearly, in this race to land a man on the moon. And American prestige must have soared in underdeveloped areas of the world where they were so impressed with the first Russian achievements in space when they did get a big lead over us back in the end of the 1950s and in the early part of this decade. And very strangely, and certainly nothing in their favor, from China, with one-fifth of mankind, 750 million people, there has been no word at all broadcast to the Chinese people about this landing yet. Peking, if indeed they're intending to tell the people anything, haven't made up their minds what they're going to say. In Russia, TASS, the official news agency, took 10 minutes to send its bulletin, and then it was just a 52-word dispatch, and Russia did not carry the television broadcast, which was easily available to it on the European Broadcasting Union's transmissions throughout Europe. The other communist nations of Western Europe, of Eastern Europe, did take the transmission, and congratulations have come from several of them. Queen Elizabeth and her royal family watched the moon landing at Windsor Castle, west of London, in latest Austria, his vacation home. Chancellor Kurt Kiesinger of Germany watched it and sent congratulations. Italy's President Giuseppe Saragat said eloquently, "Of all the sentiments that stir us, gratitude toward the American people dominates, that people formed by innumerable immigrants from every country that has given humanity so great a victory that is democratically accepted for victory or for defeat, the witness of the whole world." And in Washington, the President of the United States, of course, watched on a small television set in his executive offices, in the executive office building across from the White House. In the White House itself, Mrs. Nixon and the Nixon daughters, along with Julie Nixon's husband, David Eisenhower, and Mrs. Mamie Eisenhower, the widow of the late president, watched there at the White House. Out around the world, wherever people gathered outside and in large groups, they watched television sets. That was true at Disneyland out in California, where Haywood Hale Bruhn is standing by with a large crowd now waiting, I understand, Woody, for the spacewalk itself.
All day long, Walter, people have been from the swirling tides of Disneyland eddying to a stop in front of this big screen. There are a lot of distractions at Disneyland, but this is somehow the greatest distraction of them all, because there are a lot of rides, but there isn't so much history. And also, there aren't any tickets needed to see the moon and the things which are happening on the moon. But this crowd has been steadily growing all day. Disneyland is full of different ways of transporting people, and they have been transported past, dropped off, come in, piled up, so that it extends way back beyond the area of seats, until there are people standing, holding children on their backs, and even way back of us here on the top of the Carousel of Progress, you can see other crowds which are staring, and I think probably be getting a little bit of eye strain, staring way across to see what is happening in a place which is fuller of fantasy than almost anything that man can create. Disneyland has got a number of ersatz moons. It gives you the past, the future, but no place gives you history today except the moon, where in, I think, something like 20 minutes, if your last bulletin is right, they'll be stepping down onto it. And the people here are waiting with a kind of tenseness which has grown. At first, when it was just the machine coming down on the moon, there was a little gaiety. But now, except for the recognition of the fact that we are on, people are concentrating very hard on the screen and waiting for something that they can talk about a long time from now, having seen that first step of man on that first alien planet. And now, back to you, Walter.
And Woody, you're going to pass on to future generations that you spent the day at Disneyland. You're going to have in your files, I think, these tapes of a beautiful job of reporting today to prove that you weren't riding the giant Ferris wheel or something of the kind. Well, you said, Woody, that you didn't know according to our latest information, they'd be stepping foot on the moon in perhaps 10 minutes or so. Well, we don't really know exactly when that moment will come. The latest word from Houston now just a moment ago was that they're running now about 40 minutes behind their timeline for preparation and getting their suits on. Apparently that's quite a chore out there in that 1/6 gravity and the limited confined space, just 100 cubic feet of the lunar module to get into all that equipment. And maybe we'll go out to Grumman Aircraft in a little while and get some word from Scott McCloud about some of the problems they may be having. Right now, though, there's an interesting scene up at Central Park in New York where the city is sponsoring a moon in, and Bill Plant is there to report on it. Bill?
Walter, there may be some question as to whether man is really out of the primeval ooze all the way. Here in Central Park, there's been a rain on and off all evening long. It's quite muddy and quite wet. Nonetheless, there are about 1,000 people out here watching our program on the giant screen. What they are waiting for is the extravehicular activity that is scheduled to begin in just a few minutes. Some of them have stayed under plastic and on the ground for hours. What brought you out here tonight?
Well, it was something that we wanted to see together with a lot of people. It's something that happens once and never more.
An experience that you feel should be shared?
Yes, definitely. I don't think the world has ever been more together or doing one thing together as much as they are right now. And I think this is something that should be done.
How about you? The rain hasn't bothered you at all? You've been out here all evening?
Well, it's been a little hard, but I think it's kind of fun out here. It's more fun than sitting back in this stupid old room for this thing.
How about you?
Well, I think it's really great. It's fantastic. It's one of man's greatest achievements.
There is, Walter, a sense of community in Central Park in Sheep's Meadow, and that seems to be what it's all about. The moon inn is growing as the rain lets up, and they are waiting for what happens in just a few minutes when the astronauts leave the lunar excursion module. Now back to you.
Bill, have you got any estimate of how many people are out there?
Walter, there are probably 3,000 or 4,000 here in the park.
And I think that there are two or three places in the park where they're gathering, so you've got a good crowd there. It doesn't matter where a man is, whether he's alone back there in that stupid room, as the fellow said, or whether he is sharing this experience, as that girl said so very well, with a lot of others, as she feels they should. CBS News color coverage of the epic journey of Apollo 11 will continue in a moment.